Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You don't think that it's time that somebody cared enough to have a dream?
Why are you getting so upset? This is not about you.
Yes, it is. You are a human affront to all women, and I am a woman.
At some point, you gotta decide for yourself who you are. Can't let nobody make that decision for you.
How do you go about getting an exorcism?
I beg your pardon?
Hi, this is Mark Kermode. Thanks for downloading this Kermode on Film podcast. This week, our show comes live from the BFI South Bank, where I do my monthly MK3D show. I'm currently in the auditorium just before the show. It's going to be packed. We've got a fabulous lineup of guests on this week's show. We have Joe Cornish, director of Attack the Block and The Kid Who Would Be King. Nadine Labaki, whose Capernaum has just been nominated for an Oscar, the stars and the director of the forthcoming British film Jellyfish, and Steve Coogan, telling us all about his current release, Stan and Ollie, and the film that changed his life.
Is it? You know, why did I kind of know that would be the case? Is it too late to do Happy New Year? Or is it too year to do Happy New Late? Shall I go out and pretend that I hadn't come in before? Da 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 da. Boom. Is it too late to do Happy New Year? Anyway, we have a fantastic and super packed show for you to begin a new year. This is the beginning of our, how many years now? Have we done three? Is this the beginning of the fourth year? It's the beginning of our fourth year. We've done three whole years here. I think that is longer than Celine Dion's residency in Vegas. I'm not entirely sure, but... All right, so on to our first regular section. This is the film that changed my life. Now, I am very pleased to say that coming up soon in UK cinemas, we have The Kid Who Would Be King. We got a poster for The Kid Who Would Be King, which I just saw the other day. I saw it in a preview theatre. It was one of those weird things when you see a film in a preview theatre, you're the only person in the cinema. And it means that, you know, the way you react is completely uninfluenced by everybody else in the audience because it's just you. And I really, really liked it. Here's the trailer for The Kid Who Would Be King.
Help! Somebody help me!
Hey, leave him alone.
It's a tough world out there. And it's getting tougher all the time. And the world is not going to change.
Hello? Is anybody here?
It's you that has to change.
Something amazing happened. You have to see what I found. There's something written on the card. Put it into Google Translate.
It means Sword of Arthur.
What if it's the sword in the stone?
Please welcome the director of The Kid Who Would Be King, Joe Cornish.
Have your choice of four seats.
Very useful.
I want to point out, it's not like a kind of...
Is this too physically close?
There's
back away. Let's build up to it. I could start here and move closer. Or further away.
Should we sort of do it, depending on how well the interview's going, that we either move closer or further away from each other? Joe, I have to start by saying that I'm very much enjoyed the film, and congratulations. You made Attack the Block, and you came on the Radio 5 show when Attack the Block came out.
Uh-oh.
No, it's not uh-oh at all. And people often raise this, well, Joe Cornish came on, and he gave you a right... ear wagging, and I always said, "Well, no, but that's I thought it was a perfectly full and frank exchange of views, which I always thought it was." And I went back and watched Attack the Block again just before we did this interview. And how long ago was it now?
It was 2011 it came out, so okay. The interview would have been 2011, which is, what is 8 minus 1? What is 9 minus 1? 8.
Anyway.
I'm not here for my skill at maths.
Here's the thing. What's the statute of limitations on apologies? Because you were right and I was wrong.
Oh, well, God bless you. That's very kind of you.
Attack the Block, amongst other things, gave the world John Boyega. That was his first... His first one. Did he do it before the TV series?
It was his first film role, yeah. It was his first role in front of a camera,
wow.
Full stop. So we saw him in a play at what used to be called the Tricycle Theatres, now called the Kiln for some weird reason.
The Kiln?
A place where they cook talent,
oh,
I
yeah.
suppose.
I thought you said it was called The Kill.
No.
No.
So he had a very small walk-on part in a play. And yeah, and Attack the Block was the first thing he'd done. And he's done quite well, don't you think?
Yeah.
Off the back of that.
Did you feel a huge surge of pride when that first Star Wars trailer broke and his face was the... Because that was a sort of... Wow.
Yeah, I think that's an amazing cultural moment, full stop, when John's face pops up in that very first beat in the trailer for The Force Awakens. And yeah, it was amazing. You know, I don't want to take too much credit because... I think the best way to put it is we opened a door for him, and then entirely through his own talent and drive, he then bolted through the door all the way to the stars.
That's very good. Cool.
One of the things that motivated me to make the film, and one of the things that was enjoyable about making the film, was to give an opportunity, because we had 5 unknown kids in that movie, and to give an opportunity and to hopefully find somebody who could capitalize on it as a launch pad.
Now, once again, in Kid King, you're dealing with young heroes, and one of the things I very much like about Kid Would Be King is I like the fact that you actually appear to like all the central characters. It's set up at the beginning that they're all at each other's throats. Some of them are bullies, some of them are bullied, and yet the sort of the message of the movie is that they come together, and you are very kind of enthusiastic about the young generation, aren't you? You do think that the future lies in their hands and you feel positive about that.
I'm like Whitney Houston, yeah. I believe the children of the future. Well, it's a film, the premise of the film is a normal British boy that discovers the sword in the stone.
Yeah.
And so the legend of the sword in the stone, you know, the Arthurian legend is a time when Britain is divided. There's no king, all the tribes are warring. And then King Arthur turns up and unifies everybody, turns his enemies into allies.
Yeah.
And so that's the story we tell, but we tell it in a modern context. And so this kid has to turn his enemies into his allies. He has to follow the chivalric code. I can't even say it. So it's about bringing all these kind of moral codes into the modern world and seeing how kids respond to them. So it's part of the story that it elevates its young characters into a kind of position of heroicness.
Yeah.
But it is a common denominator between both films that, you know, Attack the Block was a film about a young criminal who then became a hero at the end. This film's about a boy who's a nobody who saves the world. And I think it's because those are the movies I liked when I was a kid.
One of the things, I mean, watching it just now in the middle of everything that's going on, it felt like the right movie for the time. It felt really encouraging to see a film that said, you know, if particularly the young generation, put the differences aside and work together, everything can be well. And I was thinking, I'm sure that when it gets reviewed, people will say, you know, a tonic for Brexit and everything. But none of that can have been happening when you were putting it, because the idea dates back to when you yourself were a kid.
Yes, when I was 13, which was a very, very long time ago.
It was the 1940s, wasn't it?
It was in the 1940s, yeah. It was a very exciting period. People who are of a similar generation to me will remember in the 80s that even if you were a little kid, stuff happening in the adult world kind of bled through. You'd turn on the TV and it would be Frankie Goes to Hollywood doing Two Tribes. You'd watch Raymond Briggs's When the Wind Blows. You'd go into central London if you lived in London or other cities in Britain, and there would be IRA bomb scares all over the underground and stuff. So weirdly, it feels like there's always a weird sense that the sky's about to fall on our heads.
Right.
And when you're young, however much you try and bury your head in, games and escapism, it does filter through, and especially to kids today, I think, because of everyone's online and you glimpse the news and stuff.
So this is a story about a kid who feels the weight of the world on him and actually has to carry that weight and then defeat it. And it's meant as a sort of empowerment fable for a younger generation who might look at us and think, well, they're fucking it up. Do you know what I mean? Rightly so, probably.
Joe, I mean, I really like the film, and I wish you all the best of it. It does seem to me to have a very British sensibility. I don't know what the international critics are like, but I think it will touch a nerve here, and I think it will do really well.
Thank you.
We asked you to choose a movie that was very important to you. We used to have a thing which was guilty pleasures, and everybody ended up saying, I'm not guilty about any of my pleasures. So in the end, we gave in, you know, and said, OK, fine, you can have a movie that changed your life. What was the movie that you chose for the movie that changed your life?
Well, this was a movie that I saw with two of my best friends, Adam Buxton, who does a popular rival podcast.
He does. No, not rival, coterminus.
Well,
yeah,
just
you know.
Get some drama into it.
Yeah. OK, very, yeah, 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 me and him.
And Louis
Theroux. We used to be on... I'm right remembering this. Didn't we used to be on the radio at the... Almost the same.
Well, I was the Radio 4 critic for a little bit, for about a year on Back Row.
Yeah, whatever it was called.
Yeah.
And so we've been like at each other's throats like for years.
It's a brutal scene.
It is.
Very homoerotic rivalry.
Yeah.
It's a bit like, what's that movie where they wrestle? Women in Love, that's right. It's a bit like Women in Love. But in cheaper suits.
Okay, so I'm Oliver Reed and you're Alan Bates.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
And that makes Nick Ken Russell. Well done. Well done.
This is hot stuff.
It is, yeah. Okay, so.
So the movie I've chosen, I went to see when I was about 18 in New York with Louis and Adam. And we'd never heard of it before. We read something in a newspaper the night before that said it was this film that had come out of the blue and nobody, and it was amazing. We went to a cinema in downtown New York. I think we smoked some herbal tobacco before we went, so we were in a really good place to see it. We were 18. And the movie was Die Hard, directed by John McTiernan. There it is, yeah. And this is an amazing film. And the reason I've chosen it is because I think it changed my life a little professionally, because it made me think about screenwriting.
Yeah.
And it's a sort of super simple and brilliant way to learn about screenwriting, to watch this film, for a few very basic reasons. The first is that the physical structure of the building is the physical structure of the story.
Yeah.
So it really shows you the nature of constructing a story in a very sort of three-dimensional living way.
Mm-hmm.
And then it brilliantly introduces this handful of characters, one by one, with very simple little character premises in them. And then almost like you're weaving a thing that you weave, almost like you're weaving a woven thing.
Tapestry.
It weaves them together and it basically touches on every character at about a 20-minute interval, builds everything to a beautiful climax, and you know, it taught me, because I took myself very seriously and was very into European films when I was a young teenager. I loved Louis Malle and Truffaut and thought I was the bee's knees and was very snotty. And then I also loved Hollywood stuff, but I saw this and I thought, wow, there's something going on there that's almost like watching an X-ray of a film.
Yeah.
Oh, you can see the structure so clearly. And I think it's influenced both Attack the Block in the way I used the block and all the different characters that weave through that. Also a little bit The Kid Who Would Be King, as well as being just incredibly entertaining and probably one of the best action movies ever made.
Based on a novel, of course, which is also actually a very well-written novel. I remember seeing this for the first time in Newcastle, and I saw it for exactly the same reason as you. I had read a review which said, I know this sounds dumb, but Cowboys and Indians in the Towering Inferno turns out to be a really, really brilliant idea for a film.
Well, the guy that wrote that book, he wrote a novel called The Detective that was made into a film with Frank Sinatra. And this was his sequel to that novel. And he wrote it after he'd seen The Towering Inferno. He had a sort of a dream about being chased through The Towering Inferno by guys with guns. And that inspired him to write the sequel.
Okay, so since we're playing nerd one-upmanship, what were the two books on which The Towering Inferno was based?
I don't know.
The Tower and The Glass Inferno.
Very good.
There we go.
You win.
So, Joe, which clip have you chosen?
I've chosen a clip from, it's about the 1 hour mark, and it is Detective Al Powell, I think his name is, has just received a call from the Nakatomi Plaza, suspected gunfire. He doesn't think there's anything major going on. Meanwhile, Bruce has uncovered, you know, has realized that the siege has taken place, the hostages have been taken. Bruce is on his own, he's being chased. So this just shows you how they weave in this character of the cop, how they push forward the other two plots, Bruce being alone and the terrorists, and then how the three of them converge.
And we're also reminded that it's a Christmas movie because there are little callbacks all the way through to
Yeah, I don't understand this debate.
There isn't a debate. There isn't a debate. It is a Christmas movie.
It's set at Christmas,
We put it in our Secret to Cinema Christmas special. Bruce Willis doesn't know nothing. He was just in the film. It is a Christmas movie. Anyway, here's the clip. Good.
You are done. No more table. Where are you going, pal? Next time you have a chance to kill someone, don't hesitate.
Thanks for the advice.
Sorry to waste your time.
No problem at all. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you.
Oh, the weather outside is frightful. Dum-da-dum, delightful. For the love...
Hey, Lincoln 30 to dispatch.
8L30, go ahead.
Yeah, that's a wild goose chase over here at Nakatomi Plaza. Everything here's okay. Over. But nobody has any guts to go. Let it snow, let it snow, let it snow.
Man, goddamn, fingers ain't crazy!
Welcome to the party, pal!
One of the things that's so great about that is actually you forget how funny Die Hard is. You forget how well timed those comic beats are.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that thing about, you know, thanks for the advice. It's really, even the moment when he says, oh, for the love of, you know, rather than Melon Farm or whatever, it is delivered with a comedian's timing.
Yeah, I have a theory that all good movies are comedies. I don't think there's a single good movie that doesn't have comedy in it. There's probably some Bergman that isn't that funny. But even, you know, The Shining, one of the scariest movies ever made, has comedy in it.
Oh, that though, The Shining definitely does. I'm sure I can think of examples of movies that don't have comedy in, but The Shining definitely has comedy.
Yeah. I think most great movies... Because, in fact, one of the stories behind this that relates to that is that when Joel Silver first got the novel was about terrorists, not about criminals. Yeah. And McTiernan and Joel Silver said it can't be about terrorists. It's got to be fun. And one of the things they did while they were rewriting it is to put comedy and put fun into it because they wanted people to have a good time on a Friday night. So that was very important to them.
Do you have this as a Christmas ritual? Is this one of the things that you watch every year?
No. I don't. I rewatched it for today. It's one of those films I know so well. You have run out of table, what did you say? It's just indelibly in my brain. And sometimes it's nice not to watch a film for 5 or 6 years because you come back to it and it feels.
But also you forget how great Alan Rickman's performance is because I think it was the first time I'd seen Rickman, you know, on the big screen, and it is astonishingly good. The whole Hans Gruber, Where Are My Detonators stuff is brilliantly done. And again, he is really funny. Well, there's all the stuff when he's talking to McClane on the, you know, on the walkie-talkie. It's a very comic performance, but really menacing.
Yeah, and this came in the wake of all those big Schwarzenegger and Stallone macho 80s. Like, the standard thing in that period was Commando and Predator and all these ridiculous muscle-bound Reaganite. So to have a kind of blue-collar hero like that, that was so physically vulnerable, to have this kind of European, sophisticated, intelligent villain was quite innovative at the time. It felt very different. And in fact, the terrorist hench people, the sort of sexy fashion terrorists, which I remember, they're more a sort of ironic reference to movies that had gone before.
Yeah.
But Willis and Rickman are kind of a very new style of hero for the
McTiernan
genre.
Went on, I'm right thinking this, McTiernan directed Last Action Hero, right?
Yes, written by one of the same writers.
Which has got that brilliant line in it in which Arnold Schwarzenegger is doing Hamlet, and he says, to be or not to be? Not to be, and the castle blows up behind him.
Yeah.
I think it's a really great film, and I do think its influence is evident in Attack the Block. So The Kid Who Would Be King is out a couple of weeks?
No, February the 15th.
February, okay, so like a month away. Oh, yeah. No, that's a couple of weeks.
3 weeks?
Yeah.
You're quibbling. It's out quite soon.
3 weeks.
Okay. And what would you say to people that they should expect from the film if you kind of, you know, encouraging an audience?
Well, it's a kids' movie. It plays incredibly well to 7 to 13, 14-year-olds. So if you have a family, bring them along. The kids will like it. Hopefully you'll like it as well. And just pay to see it. Pay double if you want to. Pay triple. Book out a whole cinema. Stretch your legs.
And the young star of it, I am right in thinking that that is Andy Serkis's son, yeah, because he looks uncannily like, yeah, like his father.
There's two offspring of famous people. There's Louis Ashbourne Serkis playing the lead, who is Andy's son, and then Celia Imrie's son, Angus Imrie, plays the young Merlin, who is extraordinary. I think he's a real breakout performance.
I am an ordinary teenager.
Yeah.
Congratulations on the film, Joe. I really enjoyed it, and thanks so much for coming on the show. Ladies and gentlemen, Joe Cornish.
Thank you. Thank you, mate. Thanks so much.
This is such a powerful film. It's such an affecting piece of cinema. Many people I know who've seen it have felt as affected by it as I have. I predict that it's on the road to awards victory. We're really thrilled to say that tonight on the show we have the director of Capernaum, Nadine Labaki. Please come to the stage. You have a choice of seats wherever you feel most comfortable.
That's fine. This is great.
Then congratulations on the movie. Firstly, since I was talking about awards, do the awards nominations matter? How seriously do you take them?
For this film in particular, yes, it does matter very much, because it will give it the right platform for it to be discussed among people, for it to be seen by as many people as possible, for it to be, I mean, this kind of movie, I think, needs the spotlight. It's going to be, if we do win, or the more we have nominations of this kind, the more light is being shed on the problem, and the more visible the invisibles will become, and the bigger the voice, their voices will resonate. Maybe not a lot of people have seen the film, but
no. Well, many won't, because it doesn't open here for a few weeks. I know it has played some festivals. Do you want to say a little bit about what the film's about?
Yeah, so it was very much inspired by lately the fact that we've seen a lot of kids being, you know, in a way deprived from their most basic rights, with the, of course, the Syrian refugee crisis growing more and more. The fact that I'm Lebanese, I live in a country that has hosted over 1.5 million refugees until now. So the problem is really, really big, and Lebanon is a very small country. It's really, if you look at the map, it's really a small invisible dot on the map. So we've, proportionally to its population, it's almost half of the population. So it's very hard. So we're seeing it reflecting on our daily lives, the situation we're struggling, Lebanese people are struggling, Syrian refugees are struggling, and we see it reflecting mostly on children, because this is what I think shocks us the most. When we see kids being neglected, being working, when you see kids, you know, on the streets everywhere, and we're not talking about hundreds of kids, we're talking about thousands of kids, we're talking about seeing this every day, you know, whether we're driving to work or coming back from, I mean, this is a sight that we are exposed with every day. So I think, in a way, it's putting the problem out there. I was thinking, you know, what goes on in the heads of those children that feel so invisible? Because unfortunately, this is what we do. We keep going, because we think that the problem is too big. We don't know where to start with it, so we just keep going, whether we're driving or walking, and we get, you know, we see those kids sometimes running behind our cars, but we don't even look their way. We act as if they're not there, and he's running behind us, and we're just going, keep going. And I think I felt at one point, how does it feel to be so invisible for him? And this is what ignited this whole journey. And I was very much also moved by the, of course, you all saw the picture of Alan Kurdi, the small refugee child who was found dead on the shores of Turkey a few years ago. And I remember thinking, you know, if this child could talk, what would he say? What would he tell the world? How would he address us, you know, the adults that have failed him? Because, you know, he paid the highest price. These kids are paying the highest price for our faults and our conflicts and our wars and our bad decisions and stupid governments sometimes, stupid systems sometimes. And it's, I don't know, we need to do something about it. So I just decided I want to do something about it. I of course, I'm not going to solve the problem, but at least I want to use whatever I know to do something about it. And I made a film out of it. I just wanted, in a way, to become their voice. And I started this journey of research with my co-writers because I felt that I wasn't entitled to imagine this story or to imagine what goes on in the lives of those kids. And this is how it started. So it started by talking to many, many, many children, then also talking to their parents, understanding the point of view of the parents, understanding the point of view of the whole community, of this community of invisible people who end up living on the margins of our societies because they're not visible. We don't want to see it. We don't want to see the problem. We don't want to acknowledge it because I think it's sometimes too big. It's too overwhelming. So I decided in a way to put a face to it, to humanize it. And it took the face of a little boy in this film who is going to sue his parents for giving him life because he's obviously suing the whole world, not only his parents, because he's in a way saying, you don't deserve me. You've created this chaos. This is what Capernaum means, actually. It means chaos. Yeah. And you don't deserve us.
So, I mean, obviously, you know, you're an actor, as we saw there, and you've directed before films like Caramel and Where Do We Go Now. Do you think that being an actor enables you as a director to get those kind of performances out of your cast? Because your cast are fat. I mean, this film is so moving, and there's not a wrong foot in the performances. Do you think that's because you were an actor?
I think it does play a big role, I think, because when you're an actor, you actually know what to expect from the director you're working with. You know what to expect from this relationship. Mm-hmm. And I think it allows you to really understand it because you're in it. You're in those shoes. So when you are in the place of the director, you actually know what the actor is expecting from you. You know. But in this case, it's very different also because those kids are not actors. So they are real people who have been having the same situation almost in their real life, a similar situation, similar experience. So what helps me is trying to draw in their own experience also, to collaborate with them in the process, to make them feel like they're part of it, because you can't expect a child to that has no experience whatsoever to do whatever you want them to do when you want them to do it. Yeah. It's impossible. You can't expect to say action and they're in it. So you have to, in a way, know how to ignite those situations for them to react the right way. And because you're working with very raw nature, nature that hasn't been altered by society's codes and society's, you know, by politics and hypocrisy and what you should be and what you shouldn't be. They're just raw nature. And actually, kids make the most sense. When they react the right way, they make the most sense. They can be the best actors in the world because there's no artifice in there. There's nothing. There's just purity. There's this real purity. So you have to just know how to create the right situation, for them to react the right way.
Yeah.
And it was all about that the whole time.
Well, it's clearly worth it. The film has worked out magnificently, and the reviews have been superb, and the awards recognition, as you say, is important. Of all the things about the film, what are you most proud of?
I'm the most, I think, proud of my actors who, you know, a few months ago, before we finished the film and while we were doing the film, they were invisible in their real life. They were struggling to exist in this life. Most of them are illegal, no papers. So for them to be able to collaborate so much in this whole process and to be able to put their struggle out there and to talk about their struggle in the film and to collaborate in the process, they felt that we're part of this mission. Each one of them was really representing and being the voice of those voiceless communities that they were representing. So to be applauded and to be recognized for the same reasons this time on such big platforms, it's an amazing victory. So I'm really proud of them for what they were able to do. Yeah. And I'm also very proud, of course, of my team, you know, because it's been a very, very difficult journey. It was a life-changing experience for each one of us. You know, even physically we changed. Yeah. You know, my DP at the end of the day, he didn't have, his beard fell off. He has like, my husband started with no white hair on his beard. Now his whole beard is white. My editor has like problems in his eyes now. It's like, it was very, very difficult.
Well, I have to say all those sacrifices are more than worth it. The film is a terrific piece of work. It opens here in a few weeks' time. It's called Capernaum. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking the magnificent Anita Bakken. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Okay, so I told you that it was an absolutely packed show. So we're going to stay with coming attractions. Here is a trailer for a British movie which has been getting an awful lot of attention, has been playing festivals and winning awards. It's coming out in a very short period of time. Here's the trailer for Jellyfish.
You know, when I gave you this job, it was with a view to you going full-time. Just makes me think, Sarah, that I don't know, that you've got somewhere else that's more important to you.
Stand up.
I am standing up.
Your act. I want you to go figure out what comedy is.
Olympics, I couldn't get tickets for the synchronized swimming, so instead I watched a woman drown through a kaleidoscope.
To do, sign on, the rent gets paid, and I look after the rest.
I can get a job.
They wouldn't employ a speed bump.
Please welcome from Jellyfish, director James Gardner, and stars Cyril Henry and Liv Hill. Guys, congratulations on the film. Liv, we met last week at the very, very glamorous London Critics Circle Awards.
Yeah.
And you were saying, you asked me at the time, you said, have you seen the film yet? Which I hadn't. And your agent, who is the agent for Gorgeous George Mackay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. She said, oh, you know, Liv wants it. Having now seen the film, I'm very, very impressed by it. It was a really terrific piece of work. And what a fabulous performance. Tell us about that central role and about that character that you play, because it's not an easy character to play.
No, so for those who haven't seen it or don't know, it's basically centres around this girl called Sarah Taylor, and she's a young carer for her brother and sister, because her mum is, I don't know what the right term for it, bipolar, and she's having a tough time at school as well, and basically her teacher sees her very frustrated and very bitter in school. She hasn't got many friends, and then she finds stand-up comedy. He introduces to her stand-up comedy as a way of an escapism, basically, yeah.
And had you'd never done any form of stand-up before, because the film obviously builds towards the possibility that you will do a stand-up act. You didn't have any...
No.
You didn't do the full Robert De Niro of going out and doing the circuit pretending to be somebody else.
No, I mean, it was sort of, I suppose, the magic is in the dialogue. It's in what James and Simon wrote. And I just performed it on a stage to a real audience, by the way. And it was really scary.
I read a thing that said that on the morning of one of the days of shooting that you were suddenly presented, that you'd rewritten the script. Was that wasn't for the comedy monologue. You said suddenly you had five... It
was for the comedy comedy monologue.
So you learned the whole thing and then he went, I've written another one.
So
thanks.
To be fair, it was his best, I think it was their best script so far, so actually I was quite relieved. But no, it probably kept it fresh. I had this really amazing editor on it. She was just amazing, and she just went, and also Cyril, I didn't really know you very well, and he just came up to me and he just went, say it again. No, say it again until I...
So you did take over a kind of teaching role?
I suppose sort of. I don't know, we're with the same agency, in fact, and...
now known as Gorgeous George's agent.
We're with the same agent, and...
Thank you.
It sort of all works seamlessly. I actually met James here at the BFI way before... anything else was on the ground, and
what, you met socially, or you met?
We met because you'd seen something, and he'd phoned the agent, and anyhow, we got talking, and at that point, they hadn't found they hadn't found Liv, and so we got talking, and the character, the drama teacher character, is not unlike the drama teacher that I had at school, and it's really the reason that I ended up going into acting. And when I was growing up, I had my own issues, and he spotted one morning very early in school, and so there were lots of bits of the script that I went, oh wow, okay, so that's, I still see this drama teacher, he lives in Ireland, and every so often.
And do you regularly credit him with your success?
Pretty much, he actually does the job of, he worked in theatre and whatever, he used to run the Battersea Arts Centre and things, but I don't know, through me coming on board, and then there was a long time of finding money and it going back and forth and scripts and whatever, and James mentioned to my agent that he still hadn't found, because we were worried about other bookings, and she said, let me read it again, and she did, and that night she contacted James to say, oh well, I'm sending you two possibilities, and Liv had just joined the agency at that point, and she was just...
Wow.
So it all sort of worked seamlessly. So I don't know, the also working with that number of children, and it was sort of... It was very, very, very low budget, no budget film.
But I imagine that for both of you, I mean, despite the fact that there's no budget, one of the big attractions would have been Margate, which is obviously... comes across so well in the film, James. Tell us about Margate.
I love Margate.
So you are from Margate?
No, but I've been going up and down for about 20 years.
Okay.
Yeah. In a former life, I was a professional skateboarder.
Yeah. And when you say professional skateboarder, you mean you did it for a living?
I kind of paid my way through uni. I used to ride for a shoe company called Vans, and they had their... yep, like them.
I'm down with the kids. I am so down with the kids.
So my team manager at the time, and he was the first guy to ever recognize my quote unquote talent as a skateboarder, and he lived in Broadstairs, so that was I was 14, and that was my first trip down to the Isle of Thanet. He was the team manager at Vans, and every time the samples that had been around the country for the shops had been out, they'd come back to the warehouse in Hammersmith, and him and I'd drive there in his transit van, stock up, fit as much as we could in the van, and then I would go back to my halls of residence and then list it all on eBay, and that was how I paid my way through university.
Were you a very good skateboarder?
I was okay.
So, Liv, it's some of the subject matter is very dark. I mean, the trailer is, you know, it's nice we see this stuff, but there is some very, very dark stuff in this. What were the challenges? What were the biggest challenges of the role?
I mean, I think it was probably because I was 16 at the time when I did it. And
so how long ago was it that you shot now? So
October 2016. So I feel like I've grown a lot because I still feel I'm a bit innocent now, but I was even more so when I was 16. I think it was a lot of it's alluded to, but the sort of what Sarah does to earn money, mm-hmm. the sexual stuff, and I had to get my head around that, about how desperate she would have to be, and so that was probably the hardest part. But I think when she is doing that stuff in the film, it's almost like there's an emotional detachment there, because that's the only way you can get through it. It's just a technicality, and it was fine to shoot because they had great people on the set, but.
And also the film, like her character, manages to keep a kind of, like, it puts a brave face on things. I mean, she's got a lot of front. Mm. She's got, you know, she chin forward. Mm. And she, from the very, very beginning, we see her giving as good as she gets in an argument in school. She's a tough character. She's not a victim.
No. I just think it's interesting because also she's 15 in there. And that is the age where you start thinking about university or not university, but, you know, you think about a life beyond school, and for her she just has no other, she just can't even think about that, and so I think a lot of it is bitter, and that's why there is this front.
Yeah.
It's just, and eventually it's just released through the comedy.
When did you all first see the film with an audience? When did you know that it was working and that it was being well received?
It was probably, we had a Margate premiere, actually. Mm.
Before, how did it go down in Margate?
It was just cast and crew. So
oh, OK.
It went out fabulous.
It was amazing. Yeah, but no, I think it was collective. Everyone was, it was done for hardly any money, so everyone was passionate about doing it because they didn't get paid. And so it was just this lovely atmosphere of everyone just, even if it wasn't successful, they come together, and we were really proud of it.
Should be said, I think 90% of the crew are in the film in various little bits.
Yeah. There was a story that you couldn't afford extra, so you just rounded up 50 random people and said, you want to be in a film. Is that right?
Yeah. That's we just kind of gathered them up, promised them sandwiches. But bless Liv, she actually got a real heckler when she was doing the performance for the first time, because I didn't want the audience to know what we were really doing, so they sat down and as if a real comedian was going to come on stage and deliver. So
and you got really heckled?
Yeah.
How was it?
Terrifying. I think if I was in character, so I sort of brushed it off as Sarah would do, but if that was really me, I would have cried.
So because you were in character, when you were dealing with a heckler, you could front it out, and you could, because you were in character.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's totally a mask. I love it, being in character.
Would you ever do stand up as a kind of, you know, now that you can do it, you've seen the hecklers?
Never. No, I have a lot of respect for comedians though, because I think it's very vulnerable. And you've got to be really intelligent.
I can't tell you how well you're setting up our next guest. It's almost like I planned this. So, Jellyfish opens in UK cinemas February the 15th. Do go along and see it. It's a very, very powerful piece of work. Please join me in thanking Liv, Cyril and James.
Nick, I think we'll crack straight on since I've overrun because I've never been known for brevity. I just said rather wonderfully that Liv had brilliantly set up our next guest, which she did. Please welcome to the stage the magnificent Steve Coogan.
So I have some slapstick.
Yeah. Steve, welcome to the show. Lovely to have you. I should begin by saying that you and I first met in Manchester in the 1980s when, and I'm eternally grateful for this, you booked the skiffle band that I played in for a do. Was it the Green Room?
Yeah. I think I was on the same bill as you at the Green Room just under 30 years ago.
This was a period when bands and comedians would do shows together.
In the late 80s, certainly there was an alternative cabaret circuit in London, but in Manchester, you either did working men's clubs who didn't understand observational comedy. why aren't you telling jokes? Or you could do arts venues, which was full of people who nodded appreciatively at your thoughts and didn't laugh. Or you could support indie bands. That was the closest it came to any kind of comedy circuit. But one of the arts venues I played was a place called the Green Room, and you, I think, were on the same bill with the Railtown Bottlers. But I did book you for a birthday party in Crumsall and paid you, I don't know what it must be, paid the band, 200 quid or something like that.
That sounds like more than I remember. I remember it was.
I'm adjusting it for inflation.
But we were really grateful, and that the band went on to end up having a job as a house band on Danny's TV show, and I'm convinced that it was your booking us for Crumsall birthday party.
So am I.
So Steve, Stan and Ollie is currently in cinemas, and I really, really like the film. I'm a huge fan of it. I thought it was lovely, and I wrote a glowing review of it in the Observer, and then when you turned up. Now I said, hi Steve, how are you doing? I love the film. And you went, oh, that's good. I went, so you haven't read the review in the Observer. And I said, do you not read reviews?
I don't not read. I'm not one of those people who say I never read reviews, because that's bullshit, of course, if anyone says that. And neither am I someone who avariciously reads them. If someone says there's a good one, I think you sort of, as long as you don't, I think when people, also, if people say really, really nice things about you, you should take that with a pinch of salt, and therefore when they say really horrible things about you, then you can dismiss that. But it's a Faustian pact. If you start to believe the hype, then you're going to get a rude comeuppance.
Okay.
But if there's a nice one, someone sends it to me, I'll read it. But someone said Mark Kermode's given us a good review, and I went, really? I was pleased. I was. I'm shocked if Peter Bradshaw reviews me well, but anyway.
Peter did like it, didn't he?
He did like it, yes. But in my mind, that's some sort of reverse psychology setting me up for when he's going to really attack me next time.
I'd like to point out that I went to school with Peter Bradshaw, and Peter once said,
You went to school with everyone.
I did, yeah. Peter once said, he said it's a fabulous thing, because I went to school also with Jay Rayner. And Peter said, it's brilliant. It shows how people say that the media is a closed thing. He said, no, it's not. The fact that we're all writing demonstrates that The Guardian don't care which year you were in our school. It was absolutely fine, so. we have a couple of clips to show from Stan and Ollie. I really love this film. One of the things I love most about it is I think the balance between the sweet and sour, between the comedy and the pathos, is just right. And when you're dealing with Laurel and Hardy, the reason Laurel and Hardy work is because, yes, they're funny, but they're funny and sad at the same time. And I do think that the film really brilliantly mirrors that. We'll start with a scene, this is fairly early on, in which they're having, this is kind of like a row with Hal Roach, who is the producer who has brought them together, and who Stan doesn't feel has adequately remunerated them for their efforts.
What are you looking for, Stan?
I'm looking for a fair price for a Laurel and Hardy picture, and you know it. Our pictures sell all around the world, and we haven't got a dime.
That's because we keep getting divorced.
No, it's because you're a cheapskate who got rich off our backs.
Oh, come on now, Stan.
He is. He's a cheapskate, a skinflint, and a parvenu.
A parvenu?
He thinks because my contract's up and yours isn't, that I won't be able to go any place else, and I'll have to take what he's offering.
Wait.
Mr. Roach?
What's a parvenu?
Well, it's someone who started out with nothing, got rich, but has no class. Look it up in the dictionary, Hal. There's a picture of you.
Oh, you think you're some sort of smart ass, huh? Well, guess what? I'm smarter.
Has she told you yet? We're setting up on our own.
Hal, it might be best if you could see your way to a small raise.
You're setting up on your own, huh? Well, how about this? Babe's still under contract with me, and I ain't releasing him.
You can't have Hardy without Laurel.
Well, that's what you think.
What for you is the key to finding your way into that character? Because obviously Stan Laurel is such an icon. How did you find your way into that character?
Well, because John S. Baird, who's sitting in the audience over there.
This is the director?
The director.
Where are you, John?
He's just there. There he is. Small Scottish man. With a big imagination. because John sort of, it all began because John offered me the role, but I was writing with Jeff Pope, who wrote the screenplay for Stan Laurel, who I've written with before.
Philomena.
I wrote Philomena about 5 years ago, and we wrote a couple of other films along the way, and he was writing this, and he said, oh, I'm writing this film about Stan Laurel. I was thinking, all right, and who are you going to cast? And he said, we're not sure. And I was like, oh, okay. And he came out the next day and said, oh, someone mentioned your name. I was like, oh, that's interesting. That could work. And I went to meet John S. Baird over there. And I just started doing a sort of, doing my, well, I could do a kind of, a sort of an impersonation, a kind of out of the pocket kind of jobby, which was a, you know, he has that sort of strange sort of mid-Atlantic accent that's half English and half American, and all the sort of about five emotions that go through his. I can do that, and he went, wow, that's great. John said, oh my god, and I said, well, it's, you know, this, and it's a fool's errand if you think that that means you've got it, yeah. And it can be a problem because it can just be shtick.
Yeah.
You know, you have to listen to what the other person's saying to go beyond being doing a comic caricature.
Yeah.
But for me, there's only so much material that exists. We all know what Stan and Ollie are like in the movies because we've seen them, but there's not much material about them in their private lives. But Stan Laurel, who retired virtually penniless because they were shafted by Hal Roach and didn't get any money from their TV shows when they were sort of reborn on television, he retired to Santa Monica in the 1950s and 60s after Ollie died, but he was still in the phone book, so people would ring him up and say, "Can I chat to you about Laurel and Hardy?" And he'd talk to people down on the phone for a long time about Laurel and Hardy, and he always responded to every fan letter that was sent to him. But some people recorded the phone calls, so I was able to listen back to these phone calls, and he'd listen to his attitude, and if anyone doesn't know, Stan Laurel was the sort of genius behind the partnership, and he was able to, the relationship that's explored on screen is that Ollie was really worked to live, and Stan lived to work.
Yeah. Well, there's a conversation that when he says, you know, everyone loves you, you know, come and have spend time with Babe. Mm. I'm actually the person who was sleeping in the editing room.
Which is absolutely true. But he said but that was anyway a key to finding out who he was. And really, it was sort of working from the outside in because we have all this physicality of him. And we heard the way he spoke when he spoke in his private life. Obviously, I thought, oh, he sounds a bit like Stan Laurel. Well, like people sometimes say to me, oh, you sound like Alan Partridge. I'm like, wow. Right. So we knew that in his private life there'd be some residue of his character. So you don't have all these clues and you try and work your way. It's strange. It's like the opposite of method acting. You don't start and build your way out. You sort of start with the external stuff and try and figure out what's going on the inside.
Yeah. I want to show another clip, which actually in the film comes just shortly after this. This is reproducing the dance from Way Out West. And I think it's a really lovely sequence, not least because the sequence itself is so iconic. And actually, so much of what Laurel and Hardy was doing was physical comedy. Tell us about the challenges of getting this exactly on point?
Well, it was something about, by the way, just on the phone calls from Stan Laurel, he said about when their physical comedy was, what they managed to successfully straddle sound when sound introduced the movie. And he says in one of these phone calls, he says, when sound was introduced, everyone started talking 10 to the dozen. And what they didn't do is they didn't throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Yeah.
They had a little bit of dialogue, but they hung on to the physicality, which is what made them funny. But doing the dance, the Way Out West dance, was pretty tough because we had to learn the dance they did in the movie. And then we do a tour of Britain. When Stan and Ollie did a tour of Britain, we had to learn the dance, two different dances, the dance they do on stage when they're older, 20 years older, and the dance they do in the movie, which had mistakes. So we had to learn the mistakes and put them in at exactly the right moment when Ollie gets two steps behind and catches up. And we didn't want, so we had to do it absolutely faithfully.
No, I understand that because in this show, the mistakes that I do are all learned. I practice them really, really hard. Let's have a look.
And I'm gonna
what are you checking
back.
With that for?
Well,
you're the director. Direct!
Next person you'll be hearing from is my lawyer.
Positions, everyone!
Comedy Western. Who came up with that smart idea?
Well, that went well.
So, who else is gonna be on this boat?
Clark Gable, some other people.
No. Women.
Oh, Carol Lombard, she's friends with Myrna.
Oh, okay, I'm gonna come.
Oh, good.
All right, show's over, let's roll sound. I said roll sound.
Speed.
Roll camera. Ready, boys?
Quiet, please. Way Out West, scene 12, take one.
Oh, what's after the curtsies?
After the curtsies, knee bend, then turn and shake.
Got it.
Camera set.
Okay, back projection. Cue music. Action.
Just watch your shoulders, snap your fingers, one and all in the hall. That's a ball, that's all. Some ball.
It's interesting. John Baird managed to track down the original back projection that they had behind them when they were doing the dance, and we reused it.
So that thing you're watching is exactly, it is the back projection that they use in the film?
In the film, yeah.
Wow. Mm. One of the things that I said in my review, which you didn't read, was that the film felt like exactly the kind of tonic that we need at the moment, you know, in the same way that the film we're talking about at the very beginning of the show, The Kid Who Would Be King, is like about, you know, kids coming together, a brighter future. I was very aware watching Stan and Ollie that, you know, for all the you know, the rivalries and the bitterness, it is a film that genuinely makes you feel good. In a, you know, it's a,
yeah, it's very, it's actually it's not sort of reinventing things. It's quite a traditional way of making a film. Actually, I think that's it's just old-fashioned storytelling. Which sometimes feels like it's fallen out of fashion. What's I think lovely about it is that there's no villainous in it. Because
no.
Sometimes you feel that to sort of celebrate love and friendship can be lowbrow or simplistic, and I think this gives light to that and shows that you can tell a story that's engaging about two people who are essentially, you know, flawed but basically good people, who, and it's a celebration of love and friendship, and it's funny as well.
And also they're matched by the comedy of their wives. At one point somebody says two double acts for the price of one, and there is this wonderful interaction between the wives at one moment. One of them says, "Oh yes, I used to be an actor," and says, "dancer actually, with a very high pain threshold." I mean, that it's just such a brilliantly delivered line by Shirley.
Yes, Shirley Henderson and Nina Arianda were superb, I have to say, in the film. And it's very hard when you're playing a supporting role to invent something that's funny and to put flesh on the bone, and they managed to. There was some of it was on the page, but a lot of it was their own invention. They really brought those characters to life, and they have their own narrative in the film.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, we asked you to choose a film that had changed your life, or a film that you were very passionate about, and you chose one which I think will be a favourite with many people in the room. What did you choose?
Harold and Maude.
So, Harold and Maude, brilliant soundtrack, fantastic work by the great Hal Ashby. What is it about the film that you love? Firstly, for those who may not know it, what's the basic
The film is about a 16-year-old boy and a 79-year-old woman who have a relationship. And they both come together because they both enjoy going to funerals of people they don't know. It's a love story, an unusual love story, and I saw it on TV, and we thank the BBC for curating.
Oh, wow.
When I was growing up, the BBC was a great sort of, was partly, you know, part of my schooling, really, because they curated films and decided what to put on TV, and so it was like a portal to something different, and I knew it was entertaining and funny and disturbing and different, and it captivated me to show that there's a way of it has all the things I love in a good film, which is it's unusual, it's funny, but it's entirely truthful and engaging, and it's full of humanity, but tells it in a very different, novel way.
We asked you to choose a clip, and you said just choose one of the death scenes, because one of the running gags is that Harold keeps staging his own death. And so we chose a couple. We showed them to you. This is one this is from fairly early on in the film. If you haven't seen Harold and Maude, this will give you a flavour of it. If you have, you will know and love this scene.
I suppose you think that's very funny, Harold. Hello?
Hello?
Faye?
Yes?
Darling, be a dear and cancel my appointment with Renee this afternoon. I know, he'll be furious. But I've had such a trying day. And with guests coming this evening. Oh, would you? That's sweet. Tell him I promised to be in on Tuesday. Thank you, Faye. You're a darling. Yeah. Bye. Bye. Oh, dinner at 8, Harold. And do try and be a little more vivacious.
I first saw it at the Phoenix in East Finchley, because it was one of those films that would be on the rep circuit. When you first saw it, did you find it funny, or did you find, because I was quite alarmed by it the first time. I didn't know anything about the story.
I felt I had a great affinity with Harold because it was my sister went to America in the mid-70s, and which we thought was this land of Nod, you know, and came back telling us all about how amazing this country was and how they had pizza delivered to their front door. You know, we thought this was like mind-blowing. she said, and there's this amazing film about a princess in space called Star Wars. But the whole... she brought back a wax skin from Universal Studios and blood. And so I used to put wounds on myself, and like a gash in my arm or vampire bites in my neck. And I actually once did a bullet hole right in the centre of my head between the eyes, and just lay on the sofa waiting to be discovered by my father, who walked in and looked at me and said, "Stephen," and I was lying there like that, and I had the blood forked across my face, and I made a crater from the skin with the bottle top, and then put the tissue in so it looked like I'd been shot very neatly. And I was lying on the sofa waiting, that's about 20 minutes, like, waiting for someone to find me. He said, "Stephen," and I was kind of thinking, oh shit, he might think I'm actually been shot. And so I went, "Yeah." He just said, "You're warped." And just left the room. So when I saw that, I was like, finally, see, look, it's a perfectly valid way to behave.
And were you an Ashby fan for the rest of his films? I mean, you know, Home, which should have won when Deer Hunter did.
Of course, all his films have a certain sort of, how can I describe it, a kind of an otherness to it. They're sort of familiar, but there's something unsettling. And it walks that tightrope between comedy and tragedy where truth can be poignant and it can be funny. And the sweetest parts of a film, I think, are where tragedy and comedy intersect and you kind of almost laugh through your tears. And that's a really sort of sweet, visceral experience for an audience to have. And I think he manages to do that in a really delicate, odd, funny way. Unsettling, but not for its own sake. Unsettling to wake you up, to make you feel alive when you're watching his films. I think, there's Coming Home, is that Being There, The last detail.
Yeah, I mean, being there, I think, is actually the least. Well, that's the one that's the most famous. But it's always, yeah, yeah. But
The Shampoo, last, which was, I mean, fantastic. Which is a great movie. And he, I think he was the editor for who directed the films with Sidney Poitier and about the racist.
Norman Jewison.
Norman Jewison. Thank you. He edited for him. And he did in The Heat of the Night and stuff. Yeah. He cut his teeth on that. And you can sort of see that in a lot of the...
Should point out, this is why Nick is here, because when you gesture towards me and I'm going like, Nick goes, Norman Jewison. I go, Norman Jewison, like I knew. You know, that's literally the reason. So if when you look back at your own career, and you've had a fantastic screen career, you've done, Alpha Papa, you've done 24-Hour Party People in Philomena. Which are you most proud? Actually, Around the World in 80 Days, which I liked.
Oh, no. I thought I'd get through an evening without someone mentioning that.
No. I thought it was funny. I thought it was kind of charming.
Oh,
yeah, there we
great.
Are. Yeah.
Why did we have to do that? I was so cool for the last 20 minutes.
Which are you most proud of?
I think, well, the one that's got this, the, can we take that down, please? I think 24-Hour Party People has a very, it is very, has a real sort of place in my heart.
Yeah.
Because it's about the hometown where I grew up. I was there when that music was happening. I knew Tony Wilson really well. He was a friend of mine before I did the movie. You know, he's dead now. He was an important part of my growing up. The idea of, you know, grammar school boys who discovered art, you know, who discovered, who are from sort of working class-ish backgrounds, who discovered, you know, literature and poetry and opened our eyes to things. And Tony Wilson was one of those people. And so playing him in the movie was, to me, was real, to me, I still can't quite believe I did it. And I love the film because it's... It breaks the fourth wall, breaks all these conventions, and not only that, but when we were doing it, it was a pretty crazy time, and when I think back to that movie, Michael Winterbottom never says cut or action; he just starts rolling the camera, and sometimes I'd be chatting afterwards, I'd look across the room and go, "Oh, he's filming me without." It's just to set the camera up because I'm talking to someone who thinks it looks. Maybe someone I shouldn't be talking to. He's got the camera on me. But when I think back now, I can't remember what was in the film and what was us just hanging out together.
Yeah.
So it feels like reality and the movie all bled into each other.
Yeah.
I've not seen the film for about 20 years because to me it'd be like looking through a box of old photographs. It'd be too poignant. So I've not seen it for 20 years, but it's the most important film to me.
I saw it a couple of weeks ago, and it is still absolutely brilliant. It's a wonderful piece of work.
Oh, Adam McKay cited it as a big influence on...
On The Big Short and
the new
and
one.
Vice.
Yeah, Vice, yeah.
Yeah. It's a better film than Vice.
I couldn't possibly comment.
Stan Nolly is currently in cinemas, and it's really, really worth your time. It's a terrific piece of work. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking Steve Coogan. Thank you. So, thanks for listening. If you like the sound of the Mark Kermode Live in 3D show and you fancy coming along, it's every month at the BFI South Bank in London. Just go to the BFI box office online for tickets, but beware, they do sell out very quickly. Or if you're anywhere near Newcastle on the 4th of February, that's Monday the 4th of February, the final show in my How Does It Feel tour comes to the Northern Stage in Newcastle on Monday. There are just a few seats left there. If you're interested, go to the Northern Stage website. Hope to see you at one of those shows soon.